Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 6, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the new book, The Conscience of the Constitution, by Timothy Sandifer. I'm Christian Corrigan, Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome two experts. Our first expert is the author of The Conscience of the Constitution, Tim Sandifer, who is principal attorney at the National Litigation Center for the Pacific Legal Foundation. Our other expert is Clark Neely, who is a senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. More complete bios for both speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. And with that, Mr. Sandifer, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. I'm very happy to participate in this call and talk about my new book, which is both mercifully short and I think is of particular interest to Federalist Society members, because I think it bridges some of the gaps between the conservative and libertarian wings that make up the Federalist Society. The book, it consists of chapters on that focus around a central theme, which is the idea that liberty and not democracy is the central value of the Constitution, and that we've been misled in our constitutional interpretations, both left and right, by the idea that democracy is the central value of the Constitution, and that liberty proceeds from democracy, or that individual freedom is a gift that is given to us by society as the majority chooses to give us those rights. That, I contend, is the opposite of what the Constitution actually requires, and the document that I point to as proof of that is the Declaration of Independence, which has been treated largely as a mere political or rhetorical statement by a lot of political scientists and philosophers and legal authorities, but I contend it is actually part of the Constitution of the United States. The Declaration of Independence creates the American nation and declares it independent, and it creates the nation on the basis of certain principles that begin with individual liberty and government as only an institution designed to preserve that liberty, which is only valid insofar as it respects that liberty. And I contend that the authors of the 14th Amendment had their eyes on that idea when they wrote the 14th Amendment. What happened was, in the years leading up to the Civil War, anti-slavery thinkers began arguing a constitutional theory that was rooted in the Declaration that said that the problem with slavery and the doctrines of states' rights was that both of those ideas were contradictory to the principles of the Declaration that were the foundation for the Constitution. The leading spokesman for that view was former President John Quincy Adams, who was serving in Congress at the time, and who is really an unsung hero in the history of American constitutional law. He inspired a generation of anti-slavery thinkers that included Charles Sumner and Abraham Lincoln. And these thinkers went on to draft the 14th Amendment in light of their perspective that liberty was the central value, that the American nation protected individual rights, natural rights, civil rights, common law rights, and that no state had any just authority to interfere with that. And I then argued that unfortunately the 14th Amendment's efficacy was radically undermined by the slaughterhouse cases in 1873, which basically nullified the Privileges or Immunities Clause of that amendment, which was intended to be the primary protection, not the sole protection, but the primary protection for individual freedom under the amendment. And when you read the slaughterhouse cases, what the court really did there was to ignore the important transformation or rededication that had been accomplished with the 14th Amendment and cling to the then obsolete states' rights view. Unfortunately, that case is still alive today. The court was asked to overturn it in McDonald versus Chicago, and it refused to do so. I think the chapter that will be of most interest to Federalist Society members is the chapter on substantive due process, because I think that the history on our side, at least, of the political spectrum, the history has been written such that, well, after the slaughterhouse cases nullified the Privileges or Immunities Clause, the courts turned instead to the Due Process Clause and started protecting rights under the Due Process Clause, which was really not appropriate, but it ended up being okay. And I think that's really a hasty and incorrect way of looking at the history. In fact, the theory of substantive due process is older than the Constitution itself. It did not originate in Dred Scott, as Judge Bork claimed in his book, The Tempting of America. In fact, the earliest expression of the theory of substantive due process that I have found was Daniel Webster's argument in the Dartmouth College case in 1819, which was quoted over and over again by courts during the 19th century as the definition of the concept of due process of law. But actually, the theory of substantive due process reaches back to the Magna Carta. If you think about it, English courts prior to the Revolution, English courts were protecting individual rights under the Magna Carta's Law of the Land Clause. What they were doing is protecting unenumerated rights, because there's no written constitution. So all of the rights that they protected were essentially unenumerated rights. So I think this, and I explained in that chapter how substantive due process works and how you really can't divide substance from procedure when it comes to due process of law. To name just one example, how do you characterize a trial? Is a trial a procedural right or is it a substantive right? A trial is a thing, and so it's a substantive right. I have a right to a trial. That is a thing. But, of course, the thing is itself a procedure, so I have a procedural right. But the trial itself is made up of other kinds of rights, such as the right to cross-examine witnesses. Is that a substantive right or a procedural right? You know, viewed from one end of the telescope, it's a procedural right. Viewed from the other end of the telescope, it's a substantive right. So the idea that you can divide substantive and procedural rights really makes no sense. It's best to see that procedural due process is actually only an aspect of substantive due process. It's one part of substantive due process. The right to a fair trial is only an aspect of the right to be treated fairly by the government, which is what substantive due process guarantees, what the due process of law guarantees. And then my final chapter is on the subject of judicial activism versus judicial restraint, and why arguments for restrained judiciaries really don't have any constitutional foundation and have led to the perversion of the Constitution. I've always said that it's very ironic that the left uses the phrase living constitutionalism when arguing that courts ought to ignore constitutional language, because the result is actually a constitution with all sorts of dead spots in it, like the public use clause of the Fifth Amendment that says government cannot take private property for private use. Now, thanks to the Kelo decision, for example, that language is basically dead letter in the Constitution. That's hardly what you would call a living constitution. So in this chapter, I argue that courts should be vigilant defenders of the conscience of the Constitution, of the principles, the moral and political philosophical principles that are in the Constitution. I think, unfortunately, the legal community, both left and right, have adopted Justice Holmes's notion from his Lochner dissent that a Constitution is made for people of fundamentally differing views. That is, in my opinion, the greatest lie told in the history of political philosophy. In fact, nobody has ever suggested that you can have a constitution of people of fundamentally differing views. Seems to me that's the problem that we're having in the Middle East right now, is that we're trying to have a constitution among people of fundamentally differing views. A constitution is for people of fundamentally shared views who might disagree about specifics or about policies, but they agree on the fundamentals. And that is how the Constitution was written. And the fundamentals we agree on were articulated in the Declaration of Independence. If you don't understand and agree with those principles, then you are not going to understand and correctly apply the Constitution of the United States. You're going to end up with a confusing mixed economy with courts preferring some rights over others and so forth, which is just the mess that we have today. So that's a quick introduction to my book, and with me on the call, of course, is Clark Neely, and I wanted to say that the reason I thought Clark was a great addition to this call is because his new book, Terms of Engagement, addresses this question of judicial activism and judicial restraint in a very effective and clear way that I think is really helpful for lay people particularly who might be deterred by the more complicated legal and philosophical concepts that I get into in the opening chapters of my book. So I think the two books really go together very well, and I thought that Clark would be able to provide us some effective insight, especially as a practitioner, on how these principles work in practice. So,
Well, thank you for that, Tim. I appreciate it. This is Clark Neely from the Institute for Justice. I want to start by congratulating Tim on an important court win that he had 3 days ago in an economic liberty case in Kentucky, where Tim just got a summary judgment in his favor on behalf of his client. Help me pronounce the names. Is it Bruner v. Zawacki?
That's right, Bruner v. Zawacki. And one thing I'm very proud of about this decision is that, to my knowledge, this is the first time since the New Deal that a federal court has ever held a certificate of public convenience and necessity requirement to violate the 14th Amendment. So we're really celebrating that victory.
And both Tim's group and my group have tackled these before. Essentially what this is it's a requirement that before you're allowed to go into a particular business, whether it's operating a limo in Las Vegas, which was a case that IJ had, or household movers, as in this case, you have to satisfy some government official that there's actually a need for that service. In other words, there's an unmet need, and you have to prove to the satisfaction of these government officials that there's a need for new service. And, of course, the existing companies get to come in and protest your attempt to get into the industry, as they apparently always did in Kentucky and always did successfully in the household moving industry, and a district court judge, quite properly in my view, held that to be a violation of due process, and I imagine we'll be waiting to find out if they appeal.
Well, we'll just beat them again if we do.
Good. All right. Well, let's dive right in. I think that one of the most principal areas of disagreement between libertarians and conservatives when it comes to constitutional interpretation and the proper role of judges in enforcing constitutional limits on government power is whether it is appropriate for judges to essentially bring to that task an understanding of a larger moral framework in which the Constitution is embedded. And generally speaking, conservatives, at least as I understand their point, are opposed to this either because they believe there is no larger moral framework in which the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are embedded and from which it is proper to draw meaning in interpreting those documents, or because even if there is such a framework, it is improper for judges to draw upon that, or I should maybe fine-tune it by saying to impose their particular understanding of that moral framework on the Constitution and by extension on the nature of the laws that they will and will not uphold. What is your response to that dilemma, Tim?
Well, I think that it is appropriate for people to be concerned about judges, you know, using the Constitution to impose their own personal views, and obviously there's a worry there. But my answer to that is that the abuse of power does not prove that the power doesn't exist. It only proves that you've got to be careful who you trust with that power, and that what the judges ought to be doing is enforcing not their own personal political proclivities, but the political philosophy that is part of the Constitution that is expressed in the Declaration. So the conservative worry that judges being allowed to enforce normative values, you know, is an open door to abuse, it's a legitimate concern. But the proper solution is that what judges ought to be doing is enforcing the principles that are in the Constitution and that they're pledged to support.
And to follow up a bit, you make the point in the book, which I certainly agree with and I think deserves some elaboration, that many terms in the Constitution would be rendered nonsensical if there were not some larger moral framework that not only exists but that is necessary to consult in order to give portions of the Constitution meaning. So, for example, how do we make any sense whatsoever of the term due process and decide what process is in fact due if there is no larger context to draw from and if the Constitution is not in fact embedded in some larger framework of value?
Yeah, a good example of this, I think, an analogy that you could draw is the Bill of Rights refers to cases at common law. It uses that phrase. Well, if you were an alien from Mars, you wouldn't have any idea what that meant. You have to know that the Constitution is nested in a framework of Anglo-American jurisprudence, and that what the idea of writ of habeas corpus, what that phrase means, you have to refer to stuff outside the document. And what you're referring to is basically principles of legal and political philosophy. And so I think the same thing has to be said when the Constitution refers to liberty, for example. You often hear people say, well, unenumerated rights to, you know, whatever the situation might be, that these things are unenumerated rights. I've always found that somewhat ironic because, in fact, liberty is an enumerated right in the Constitution. And the question then is, what does liberty consist of? If you're like a positivist, like Judge Bork, and you say, well, if the right isn't listed in the Constitution, then it's not a right, then I don't have a right to run barefoot through sprinklers on a hot summer day. But of course I do have that right because that's part of my liberty, which is an enumerated right in the Constitution. So even the whole enumerated, unenumerated distinction I don't think really holds water.
Yeah, let's talk about Bork for a moment because, of course, he was one of the leading intellectual influences on a whole generation of conservatives and particularly conservative proponents of judicial restraint. And one of the things that I think is so amazing about the fact that Bork came to be the sort of the intellectual godfather of this movement is that Bork portrays himself as a moral relativist in his writings. In other words, he really takes the position that there's just no way to distinguish between, for example, your desire to run through a sprinkler on a hot summer day and feel the grass under your feet, and my desire that you just sit in a room in the darkness and think about things other than, you know, running around outside. And that there's just, you wanted to do one thing, which was go outside and enjoy the sunshine, and I wanted you to do a different thing, which is to stay inside and not do that. And Bork takes a position that there's just no moral basis for making a distinction between our two desires. How does that factor into your understanding of the proper interpretation of the Constitution?
Yeah, that's right. Bork is an explicit moral relativist, and yet that was often overlooked by many of his admirers. And the most shocking example that I give in the book is that when you actually read the Tempting of America, he comes out and says that there is no moral objection to rape. The laws against rape are simply the majority's arbitrary and irrational preference to allow women not to be raped, and therefore the majority could revoke that right not to be raped if it wanted to. I mean, that's actually the example Bork himself uses, which is a really extreme proposition. And aside from whatever we might think of that as political or as ethical philosophy, and it's lousy ethical philosophy, but even putting that aside, it's inconsistent with the text of the Constitution, which in the Ninth Amendment says, the enumeration of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others. And Bork interpreted the Constitution with his extreme positivism to such a degree that he could not understand the Ninth Amendment. And so he famously dismissed it as a mere ink blot on the Constitution and said what is simply false, that there was no history to tell us what the Ninth Amendment was intended to accomplish. That's an exact quote, which is simply a falsehood. The Federalist Papers, Madison's speech introducing the Bill of Rights, and so forth, all explain exactly what the Ninth Amendment was intended to accomplish. And what it was intended to accomplish was to say, do not read the Constitution the way Judge Robert Bork does. But that is the popular philosophy today because modern, more ethical thinkers have adopted this essentially baseless distinction between is and ought. They think you cannot go from is to ought. And therefore, the only thing that whenever we say something ought to be some way or ought not to be some way, that is simply an arbitrary personal taste or preference. And therefore, they must all be equally arbitrary. And therefore, law itself is essentially arbitrary. And so they focus their attention on who is the lawgiver instead of what is the lawgiver actually doing and why. This is a theme that was picked up by Lon Fuller very effectively in The Morality of Law.
And let me try to bring this to a more practical level, because one of the things that I think is deeply ironic about the fact the extent of Judge Bork's influence on the current generation of judicial conservatives and their embrace of a very hands-off form of judicial restraint is that it does go back, it does depend fundamentally on a moral relativist view of at least our culture, if not the universe. And this is something that conservatives in other contexts really rail against, and they actually berate humanities departments and professors in humanities departments who are moral relativists, because that's wrong, and it's self-evidently wrong, at least outside of the context of what we're discussing today, which is constitutional interpretation. So it's surprising to me that conservatives who quite correctly denigrate the idea of moral relativism in other settings embrace it, at least tacitly, in this one. And I'd like to give two concrete examples just to illustrate how I frankly think preposterous the moral relativist view is in this setting. One is, and we don't have to talk about hypotheticals like whether, rape is or is not objectionable morally, according to Robert Bork, but There was a case that some of the listeners will be familiar with, Abigail Alliance v. Eschenbach, and the issue in that case was whether there's a fundamental right of access on the part of terminally ill cancer patients. These are people dying of cancer for whom no other drug or therapy has worked, and they want to take experimental drugs that have already passed phase one of FDA testing. In other words, they've been determined to be safe for widespread human testing. They just haven't been determined to be efficacious yet. And by, I believe, a vote of 8-2, the en banc D.C. Circuit rejected that claim and said there is no fundamental right of access to a potentially life-saving drug on the part of somebody who is already terminally ill. Now, let's boil that down to its essence. What we're essentially saying here, at least if we sort of translate Bob Bork into modern times, is there is no moral distinction that can be made between your desire to take a drug that might save your life and my desire that you not take that drug that might save your life. And to me, that really lays bare the absurdity of the idea that there really can be no moral distinction between these kinds of values. And I'll give another example from my own practice. I, like you, Tim, I do economic liberty work, and we had a case in Louisiana where there's a state law that says you have to have a license to be a florist. You have to have a government license to sell floral arrangements. And when that law was upheld, as it was by a district court judge, the underlying jurisprudential premise there is, You know, our client Sandy Meadows wanted to go out and earn a living by selling floral arrangements, and at least some legislators wanted her not to do that. And how am I as a judge to make any moral distinction between her desire to put food on her table by engaging in a harmless occupation and some other people's desire that she not do that until she meets their standards? And I guess it strikes me that if we are really incapable of making those sorts of moral distinctions in this country, then we are imputing to the framers a kind of a moral nihilism that they just that is totally unfair and frankly a bit of a slander against them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'm glad you brought up the Abigail Alliance case, because I've always considered that one of the most heinous decisions that federal courts have ever made. Of course, the problem is really in the vocabulary with which the courts even begin to address these questions. They come to it looking for a right instead of looking for where does the government get the authority to restrict freedom in the first place. And that's because of the basic presumption of constitutionality that is part of the progressive outlook, which is to say that since democracy is more important than liberty, we're going to begin by presuming in favor of the government unless an individual can negate that presumption, either by pointing to a fundamental right, which is a category that is arbitrarily drawn by the courts in the first place, saying some rights are fundamental and some rights aren't. There's no foundation for that in the Constitution. That was invented by progressive political philosophy. And then we're going to force people either to point to this arbitrary category of rights, or we're going to require them to negate every possible conceivable basis for the law, which is, literally speaking, impossible to do. And so the terms with which we approach it then are already corrupted. We start looking for a right instead of looking for making the government justify its restrictions on liberty. And obviously that's the case when it comes to economic liberty and licensing laws. Such as in Sandy Meadows' case. So, I think the basic corruption is in the moral relativism that has led us to say, well, since we can't decide that there is such a thing as moral truth, therefore it's just up to the majority to decide. Which, by the way, is also a non sequitur. If it were true that there is no moral truth, then why in the world should we rely on the majority to decide moral truth? Positivism, both in its conservative and liberal varieties, is really basically anti-philosophy and anti-law, and it's just an arbitrary preference that openly declares itself to be an arbitrary preference for the majority over the individual. And it is inconsistent with our legal institutions at the very least. It's bad philosophy and it's bad law.
Let me push back on that just a little bit. Let's accept at face value the proposition that you and I both dispute, but let's for the sake of argument, accept that either there is no objective morality, or it is inappropriate for judges to consult it in interpreting and applying the Constitution. couldn't a case be made for the idea that at least with pure democracy, or at least with honoring the expressed will of a majority, you are thwarting the desires of the fewest number of people? And if you have literally no other metric to go on, because there is no objective morality and there's no other framework for deciding a given case than that, then at least what you're doing as a judge is you are thwarting the will of the fewest number, the least number of people, and that's maybe as good as you can do in some cases.
That's an interesting way of putting it. I think what you often see is something very similar to that argument, which is that well, if we do it that way, if we thwart the least number of preferences, then the majority can change the law if they want to, because you know if the minority doesn't like it, they can go to the legislative hall and have that thing changed. And the problem with that is that you can't compare these kinds of values simply on a person by person basis. Like, you know, for instance, if we were to say, well, we're thwarting the least number of people's interests in the Sandy Meadows case, for instance. Now, her interest was to be a florist and earn a living for herself and her family. And the interest of the majority was what? The majority really didn't have any interest in the case. They didn't care. The majority doesn't – I mean, it comes down to a fraction of a penny to them as far as the increase in the cost of floral arrangements is concerned. The vast majority of humanity could not possibly care less about the licensing laws in the state of Louisiana for the florist industry. So I don't think it's possible to do that calculus, and it shows how the public choice problem, rent seeking, is really the operative concern. And the founders were aware of this. They called it the problem of faction, that any democratic society, those people who stands to gain from restricting individual rights are going to gang up and get legislation passed that restricts individual rights for their benefit. And then you turn to the individual who's suffering and say, well, if you don't like it, you can go to the legislature, which is simply a falsehood. The individual really has no political influence to protect himself in the political process. That's why we have a constitution, to protect people from the political process and from having their rights violated in that way. And that problem is even more compounded when you realize that most of the laws that we live under in our lives are not even passed by legislatures. They're passed by hired bureaucrats in administrative agencies who are basically immune to voter control. And, ironically enough, courts defer to them, even though these are fundamentally anti-democratic entities. And the courts' whole rationale for deferring is because they supposedly pledge allegiance to democracy. Here they're deferring to administrative agencies that are anti-democratic. So I think the whole thing is a mess when we approach it from the terms of, well, these interests are interchangeable. They're not interchangeable in a proper understanding of human nature, which is present in the Declaration and the Constitution, puts the balance in favor of individual freedom.
And here's a question that we can maybe kick back and forth, since we both had similar experiences as constitutional litigators, and that is, you quote in your previous book, Right to Earn a Living, you quote Professor Robert McCloskey as saying that the idea that an individual who has been locked out of a profession like Sandy Meadows with floristry, or any one of our hair braiding clients, or your client Alan Merrifield, who was a pest controller in California, that they have a realistic ability to go to the legislature and lobby for a law to be changed so that to remove the barrier to their being able to work in that occupation is, quote, an amiable fiction. In other words, if you have any sophistication at all in public choice theory and economics, you understand that that is virtually impossible to do. And yet, the idea that it is quite possible, and that in fact that is precisely the way our system expects people who have been locked out of an occupation or whose house is about to be bulldozed in order to be given to a private property developer, et cetera, that should be the only means available to them to essentially vindicate what they believe to be their right to property or the right to earn a living. And it appears to me that basically everybody outside of the judiciary understands that that is an amiable fiction and completely nonsensical. So why is it still a central premise of judicial restraint and the idea that courts shouldn't get involved, and that, as the Supreme Court said, I believe in the Lee Optical case, that for such abuses, people must turn to the legislature. For the correction of such abuses, you must turn to the legislature.
Well, first of all, I think the reason why it's still prevalent in courts is, it reminds me of an old saying. I think it was the physicist Leo Szilard who said that old theories never die, just old theorists. And that's doubly true in the law, which takes the long view and is supposed to be a long-term sort of conservative restraint on how things change in society. So long-standing doctrines persist far beyond their utility, if they ever even had any utility. So it's just, it's precedent now. It's been 70 years we've been using this rational basis test, and courts are reluctant to change it. I'm very optimistic about the rising generation of legal scholars who are taking a second look at this idea of judicial deference. The debate between Professor Barnett and Judge Wilkinson at the Federal Society event in November, I think, was easily, hands down, won by Professor Barnett, and I think it demonstrates that the Federal Society's own members are really rethinking this question of restraint when it comes to the judiciary. And then as far as the inevitable fiction, it's interesting because the origins of the administrative agency, progressives take a very romanticized view of administrative agencies and of the democratic process in general. And I mean that in the technical philosophical sense also, not just that they're sentimental about democracy, but the roots of administrative government, philosophically speaking, are in Hegel. And in the romanticist thinkers, the historicist and romanticist thinkers, beginning really with Rousseau, who think that the people express a spirit in the form of their democratic institutions and that the individual's consciousness is created by that spirit. And so administrative agencies are expert entities designed to implement the will of the people in this abstract sense. That was certainly the view of people like Woodrow Wilson, who were the founders of the administrative regulatory state. And that philosophy just ignores the public choice dynamics, the whole principle of the danger of the faction. If you're clinging to democracy as your ultimate view, as your ultimate value, you really have no reason to fear faction. Why would you be worried about the mischiefs of faction? You can't even recognize the mischiefs of faction as being mischiefs if your idea is that the majority is always right.
Well, it's maybe that's a good note to I don't know about end on, but at least transition. I want to tie a couple things together. One is that I share your optimism about the new crop of not only scholars, but there's some, I think, what we at IJ would call very engaged judges who are now who are younger, who are recent appointees or you know have filled the office recently. And so there's a lot to be, I think, encouraged about there. I shared your impression of the Professor Barnett Judge Wilkinson debate back in November. And I remember very clearly the audience's reaction when Judge Wilkinson acknowledged that this would be an unpopular position, but he told the audience that he thought that Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in the Affordable Care Act case was courageous and it was correct. And that really, I think, to me, laid bare the distinction that exists now between very hardcore proponents proponents of a very hardcore version of judicial restraint and people who are giving that doctrine a fresh look when they realize that the application of that doctrine leads to results like the upholding of the Affordable Care Act on the basis, the ludicrous basis, the ridiculous proposition that the federal government was exercising its tax power in that case, which it
yeah, in fact,
wasn't.
In fact, he says, in that opinion, he says, the line that is really the summation of all of what we've been talking about, he says, it's not the job of the courts to protect people from the political process, which is
right.
Simply false.
Right. Well, if we're still waiting for questions, let me give you one more topic that maybe you and I can discuss, which is what we often hear, those of us who advocate a more robust approach to judicial review often hear concerns expressed about judicial tyranny and the idea, that judges will impose their will on people and it will be tyrannized by a different branch of government. And I think there are a couple of reactions to that, and maybe we can discuss them, but one of them, very practical reaction I have is you are subject right now, all of us, to so many laws that they are impossible to count. People have actually tried to count the number of federal criminal laws and have been unable to do it. They can only estimate that there's between 4,000 and 5,000, another 80,000 to 120,000 federal regulations with criminal penalties, and countless state and local laws. Now, one question to ask is, how many court orders are you personally subject to yourself today? How many court orders actually restrict your ability to go out and do something that you want to do or order you to do something that you'd rather not do, with one exception, and that is preventing you from imposing your will on other people. There are certainly plenty of court orders that prevent you from going out and silencing somebody who wanted to say something that you didn't want to hear, and you wanted to pass a law saying, hey, you know what, you can't say that in my presence, or you're going to have to salute this flag every morning when you go into school. But with putting that aside, putting aside the area of life where you wanted to impose your will on other people, and judges made it impossible for you to do that, just exactly how many court orders are any of us really subject to at any given time, and how does that compare to the sheer number of laws and regulations that we are subject to from the other two branches of government?
Yeah, that's very well put, and it makes a good adjunct to the observation that Madison makes in the Federalist, that when he says that the legislature is by far the most dangerous branch of government, that is always, what is it, sweeping into its impetuous vortex more and more power. And, of course, the legislature has demonstrated, whether it be state or federal, has demonstrated that it is perfectly capable of ignoring the courts if it wants to, or pushing back against any perceived court interference with its prerogatives. All it has to do is either ignore the court entirely, which often happens, or just slightly amend the law that's in question and repass it, or change the makeup of the bench or restrict its jurisdiction. Courts have Congress and state legislature have very strong powers against courts. And this is actually a point, this reminds me of a point that you make in terms of engagement that I was an excellent point I had not considered, that what we have, thanks to judicial restraint, is a basically the foundation of a class system. Which we see going on all around us, a government class versus the citizen class, because Congress pulls, you know, they hold these hearings for judicial nominees, and basically they grill them on the single question of how much are you going to defer to us? How much are you going to let us get away with? And they approve nominees to the bench only who convincingly genuflex to the notion of judicial restraint, like in Chief Justice Roberts' case going on about judicial humility. And every, you know, there's always somebody has to bring up Lochner and say how Lochner was terrible and so forth and so on. And so what you have is, the thanks to the doctrine of judicial restraint, we have a Congress that ensures that the courts are as filtered as they possibly can be against judges who are likely to protect individual rights.
Yeah, I have to admit to a recurring fantasy that one day we will see a chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Cruz, or a chairman, Lee, who will begin the next Supreme Court nomination by saying, the first thing we're going to talk about is your theory of limited government, and if you don't have a pretty concrete one, this is going to be a very short hearing. I don't know if that's a complete fantasy or not, but it is something that goes through my mind quite a lot. And given what we have seen from, you know, some of the new members of the Senate, I think it's not inconceivable that we could see a hearing like that. And it would certainly be a change from what we see now, where all we really hear from the senators are all these concerns about judicial activism, which, when a politician uses the term judicial activism, that's just code for judges saying no to what we have done, judges striking down laws that we have enacted. That's what they mean when they say judicial activism. And you're right. The whole, if you go back and look at the last few Supreme Court hearings, they're mostly about impressing upon the nominee how concerned the senators are about judicial activism, which is to say judges striking down laws, and asking the nominee what they will do to fix this problem. And of course, there can only be one answer, which is nothing. I will never say no to you guys. Maybe one or two areas I really care about, but other than that, I'm a restrained person, I'm humble, I'm modest, and pretty much whatever you ram through the system, you're not going to have any problem with me. And of course, that's exactly what happened with the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, you know, it actually appears that sort of no level of you know, repellent kind of special dealing and backroom deals and the Cornhusker kickback and the, you know, Gatorade and all of that. Like, basically, there can be no you know, level of foulness in terms of how a law gets passed that is so much that a judiciary might step in and say, hey, listen, you know, that, first of all, that really wasn't democratic, and second of all, we're really serious about having a federal government of enumerated powers, and this just doesn't even come close. So anyway, I think the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee made it clear that what they wanted was restraint, modesty, and deference, and boy, did we get it.
Yeah, well, there's a famous incident when then-Senator Biden held up a copy of Epstein's book, Takings, and, you know, do you believe in the doctrines taught in this book? And, you know, my license plate on my car is the case citation for Lochner versus New York, 198 U.S. 45, which is perfect. It fits on a California license plate. And I've always had this nightmare that someday somebody will hold that up at a Senate hearing and be like, you think Lochner was rightly decided? Well, Senator, yes, I do.
That'll be a short hearing, too.
Well, Clark and Tim, this is Christian Corrigan. If you two are ready, I think we've got over about 75 people on the line, and I think that I'm sure at least a few of them have some questions for you. So if we're ready, we can open it up to callers with about 20 minutes to go.
Bring it on.
Great. Well, for those of you on the line, we'll now open the floor to your questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. Again, that's star and the pound key. And a quick reminder to please keep your questions as brief as possible, and please do make sure that you actually do include a question in there. And if you've got one for either Mr. Sandifer or Mr. Neely, we'll go ahead and take those right now. All right, looks like we've got a number of callers, and we'll get to the first one right now.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you very much for that engaging discussion. I'm enthusiastically in agreement with both of you, since I deal with an administrative agency, FERC, nearly every day. But there was something that rang incorrect about the reasons you were giving for the problem with deferring to agencies. And as soon as you said it, I thought, that's not quite how Chevron works. I was wondering if you could re-articulate your case against agency deference, just so I can hear it again and understand what my objection was, mostly because I want you to be successful, and so I would like you to frame your argument in a way that's persuasive to people who aren't already adherents to your worldview.
I'm glad you asked that, because the administrative deference thing is more complicated than I suggested. Of course, the theory that judges, for instance, Justice Scalia advances, is that the reason for deference to an administrative agency is administrative agencies are executive entities that are given a limited discretion to go out there and enforce the law, and that's required to some degree in every instance, because the executive has to make certain on-the-spot decisions about how and where and just what he's doing when enforcing the law. And so he is – I think Justice Scalia, for instance, is very, very vigilant about the idea that administrative agencies shouldn't be acting as legislatures, but they come up with rules for how they're going to go about enforcing the law. And that was made clear in the recent decision on that question, which I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, the FCC versus Arlington case. But in broader terms, the reason for the deference to administrative agencies, I think, is rooted in this progressive romanticism of democracy, and that is that to the progressives, administrative agencies were these scientific expert entities that would be insulated from the democratic process in order to properly administer the will of the people as expressed in statutes. And there was no need for political checks and controls against them, because they would appropriately organize society to suit the needs that were expressed by the people. I have a quotation about this in the end notes of my book, where James Landis, chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the 30s, said that the rise of the administrative process represented the hope that policies to shape economic fields could most adequately be developed by men bred to the facts. That hope is still dominant, but its possession bears no threat to our ideal of the supremacy of the law. Instead, it lifts to great new heights, where the judge, like the conductor of a many-tongued symphony, from what would otherwise be discord, makes known through the voice of many instruments the vision that has been given to him of man's destiny upon this earth, end quote. So I think you see in the foundation of the administrative state this romanticist notion of democracy over the individual. And that's why at bottom you have deference to administrative agencies. They're supposed to be experts. They are created by the legislature, and they express the will of the people. And so even though the administrative process, at least at the state level at least, which is the only place I've dealt with it, involves a lot of violation of the rules that we would consider proper due process. Administrative agencies are allowed to base their decisions on stuff that would never satisfy the normal rules of evidence. And then when you appeal from those decisions by seeking a writ of mandate, for example, the record is locked, and you are not allowed to introduce new evidence that might contradict the faulty and often fraudulent evidence that these administrative agencies employ when making their decisions.
All right. Well, it looks like we've got a couple more callers, so we'll move right ahead to our next question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Perhaps you should examine the natural law theory under that is, forms the background to our Constitution. There is not much a matter of conscience or a conception of morality or what people ought to do as a descriptive approach to human nature as part of a natural law and how human beings will behave morally. And that forms the foundation for the law and the Constitution as it was understood by the founders. And we might further point out that there are only about 80 terms in the Constitution that are ambiguous and that are the subject of dispute. Most of the rest of it is unambiguous and is generally not disputed. And the originalist analysis for each of those 80 terms may differ somewhat from one term to the next. So a single originalist method is not necessarily appropriate for all ambiguous terms. We need to look at the historical legal record for each of them. As I have done on Constitution.org, where I have developed a list of all of those rights that I can find in the historical record that would be contained in the Ninth Amendment, but not made explicit there.
I'll answer that by saying the term conscience of the Constitution, I can see why that might be misleading at first in that sense that it is correct that the classical natural law thinkers don't think of morality in terms of individual conscience. They think of morality, and I think correctly so, as more akin to something like a healthy diet. It's a matter of human nature and understanding what is going to make a person a good person in the same way that nutrition is about knowing what is the proper diet to make a person a healthy person. And I think that's the correct way of approaching ethics. My term conscience is because I perceive I'm trying to analogize the Declaration of Independence to being the conscience that tells us how to interpret the Constitution when we're doing that task. I would disagree about ambiguity. I think every linguistic term can be seen as ambiguous if you draw the circle broadly enough. For instance, the Constitution says the president must be 35 years old. You might think that's completely unambiguous, but if you were a Martian who had just landed on Earth, you might have to be reminded that we mean 35 Earth years and not 35 Martian years. Every term has some context that gives it that meaning, and sometimes we don't think about how we're applying the context because it's obvious to us, but nevertheless we're applying it. And I'm just saying that we do exactly the same thing when we interpret the word liberty in the Constitution as we do when we're interpreting 35 years in the Constitution. As far as originalism in terms, you're right. The different terms in the Constitution require different kinds of approaches that still would fit, I think, within the broad term of originalism. For instance, the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment clause. I think the term unusual just inherently requires us to compare the punishment to contemporaneous punishments and not to past history of punishments. That's a point on which I strongly disagree with Justices Thomas and Scalia, for instance. But I am no longer really comfortable calling myself an originalist, and I do not make an originalist argument in Conscience of the Constitution. I think of myself more as a natural law, natural rights person. Maybe it's certainly that aligns with originalism in strong degrees, but I'm not trying to make an argument that the text itself by itself or our commitment to originalism compels us to read the Constitution in this way. I agree with the Founding Fathers, not because they were the Founding Fathers, but because I think they were right.
Anything else on that question before we move on to the next one?
Not for me, no.
All right.
Hi, this is Kurt Levy from the Committee for Justice. I want to disagree with a couple of things that were said and get Tim and Clark's reaction. I thought I heard I think it was Tim, say that strict construction, which ties the hands of judges to some extent, is morally relative. That I don't understand, because the Founding Fathers put moral principles such as liberty and self-determination into the Constitution, so the Constitution is not morally empty. I mean, my objection is not the Founding Fathers putting morality into the law. It's judges doing it. I don't know if there's an absolute morality that comes from a higher authority, but either way, I don't know why you would want judges deciding what the moral truth is. You know, as Scalia has famously said, judges have no more moral expertise than people pick randomly out of the phone book. The second thing I disagree with is the idea that deferring to democratic decisions where the Constitution isn't clear is an arbitrary way to make moral determinations. Again, we can debate if there's an absolute, you know, morality that comes from some higher authority, but as a practical matter, the morals that govern society come from the people. So it makes sense to look to the people in determining morality. As I know, you know, Clark is aware, I agree that Abigail Alliance was a morally heinous decision, and I think you can make a good argument that it was legally wrong. But if we, you know, put that aside, I mean, obviously the court disagreed that there were good legal arguments. You know, it seems to me the democratic process is fine with the FDA restrictions, and so it's certainly possible that most Americans, you know, disagree that those restrictions are heinous. And if so, you know, what basis do I have for putting my moral judgments above those of most Americans? Again, if the law says those restrictions have to be struck down, that's a different question. But if it's just moral judgments, you know, what right do I have to consider my moral judgments superior? And I guess I'll stop there and get a reaction, hopefully, from Tim and Clark.
I'll start by saying I think I don't argue that strict constructionism, or as you phrase it, is morally relative, or that restraining courts is necessarily morally relativist. I agree that the Constitution contains moral propositions, and that a court that's faithful to those moral propositions is then being faithful to the conscience of the Constitution. And this is a point I think that Clark makes very effectively in his book, which is that judicial restraint is just as active as the court going in there and arbitrarily inserting something into the Constitution. When the court says, you know, taking away Suzette Kilo's property to build luxury condominiums is, you know, well, it's true that that's a private use, but we're just going to look the other way and call it macaroni. That's just as active as a court saying that they're going to overly enforce the Constitution. As far as why judges should enforce moral truths, I think they're obligated to do so, at least in some respects, because they are judges. I think one of the problems with approaching this whole argument is that people tend to think of judges as being outside the democratic process, and they aren't. Judges are part of the properly understood democratic process. The judges are chosen by the people in an indirect form, in the same way that the Secretary of State is chosen by the people. But in fact, it's rather more directly than that, because a lot of people choose their presidential candidates based on who that person's likely to appoint to the bench. Our friend Clint Bowler just recently published a book on just this subject, saying vote for the presidential candidate based on his likely judicial nominees. So I think that the courts stand within the democratic process, properly understood, as a restraint against the people doing wrong. The people know they do wrong, so they create a constitution that is intended to lash themselves to the mast. As for whether deference to the majority is arbitrary, the point I was trying to make is this. If you do not agree that morality is created by the majority, if morality is something else, like if morality is what is good for human beings, as opposed to just whatever the majority preference is, then there is no more reason to defer to the majority on moral questions than there is to defer to anybody or anything on moral questions. If you think that morality is something, then the fact that a bunch of people disagree with you doesn't change that fact. On the other hand, if you think morality is purely arbitrary, it's just totally based on whim, then there's also no reason to defer to the majority, because there's no reason to think that a majority's whims will be any more valid than the minority's whims. So there's really no reason to defer to the majority on moral questions at all, as far as I see it, unless you think that morality is simply created by the majority.
Kurt, this is Clark. I appreciate your question. They're always enlightening and intriguing. And I have three responses to that point. It's a fair point. It's one that comes up anytime we have a discussion like this. My first point is that I interpret the Constitution as charging judges with doing exactly what you're asking about. In other words, with enforcing unenumerated rights. The Ninth Amendment specifically says that the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others. And, you know, I think it would be difficult to come up with a more clear definition of the word disparage than to have one set of rights that gets meaningful judicial protection, and those are what the Supreme Court calls fundamental rights, and then another set of rights, non-fundamental rights, that get no meaningful protection, just what I call fake judging in my book. And to me, that is very obviously to disparage whichever rights get put in the non-fundamental, make-believe, meaningless, whatever you want to call it, category. So that's point one. And I would add, by the way, that taking a provision of the 14th Amendment, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and I hate to say it so bluntly, but falsely asserting that there is insufficient amount of evidence to draw any conclusions about the intended meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause and then reducing it to an ink blot is just simply not an intellectually appropriate way to do constitutional law. So my first argument is textual. My second is to challenge the idea that we are in fact, or that judges would in fact be deferring to Democratic majorities in a significant number of cases. They're not. They're deferring to a political process that we characterize as democratic, but that we know in operation often operates in a very non-democratic fashion. So you don't really even have the moral force, whatever moral force there may be, you really don't even have the moral force, for example, of saying, hey, the people of Louisiana got together and said, we don't want people to work as florists without a license. That didn't happen. A faction got together and basically cajoled enough legislators into supporting that law, but it in no way reflects, I don't think there's any empirical basis for saying that it reflects the majority of the will of the majority of the people of the state of Louisiana. My final point is this, and that is that there's a lot of interesting theoretical arguments out there about what, if anything, makes the Constitution binding. Randy Barnett argues that it can only be binding in conscience if it protects rights that we have when we're in a state of nature and that we do not give up when we come together. Other people use a more of an overtly contract theory, but at a certain point, I think you have to ask yourself, is it really reasonable to suppose that we came out of a state of nature and gave to other people the power to control us in the most minute areas and some of the most important areas of our life without offering us any kind of a moral or rational explanation? So I want to have kids one day, and you don't think I'm smart enough to have kids, and you don't want my kids to be in the gene pool, so you're just going to sterilize me. And, of course, that happened throughout the 20th century. You could do that for any reason or no reason, according to this view of the Constitution. I am simply not owed any kind of reasoned explanation for why you propose to sterilize me and prevent me from ever having children. And I think that is an extraordinarily repugnant view of civic society and an extraordinarily repugnant view of the Constitution to most people. And so for those three reasons, I would reject the idea that we can just sort of glibly say, hey, you know, in areas where the Constitution doesn't 100% clearly speak to an issue, then we just, you know, leave it to the political process, and we just can't do any better than that. I don't think that's right as a matter of text. I don't think it's a matter accurate as a matter of descriptive sort of political philosophy, and I think it's wrong as a matter of morality.
Well, it's it's morally repugnant to most people, sterilization, but I think the point is that where it's morally repugnant to almost everyone, the democratic process can take care of it. What we're really talking about here are issues where people don't agree, and then it comes down to who gets to decide. And that, it's not that I don't think there's an absolute morality, it's that who gets to decide what it is. And the idea of judges being the ones who get to decide scare me. Again, I agree that judges are part of the democratic process, but I think their role in that process is to interpret the law, not to be quasi-philosopher kings that determine moral truths.
Well, fair enough. I mean, I'd explain why I think that's wrong as a matter of text, and I would simply add, Kurt, that waiting for the democratic process to get it right didn't work out so well for about 60,000 Americans in the 20th century who were sterilized against their will and had very little access to the political process, and it took a very long time for that injustice to be created. And you may be right that, you know, your interpretation says that we just, you know, they just have to wait. It's too bad to be Kerry Buck, but you just have to wait for your friends and neighbors to become enlightened. But others of us say, no, when the Constitution has charged judges with enforcing unenumerated rights, then they have an obligation to step in and make some effort to determine what those rights might be.
And I'll add this, which I think would be a good way of summing up the hour, which is that I'm not arguing that judges simply enforce their interpretation of morality per se. What I'm saying is that the Constitution incorporates a moral and political framework, which the judges are obligated to enforce by their oath to enforce the Constitution. And that moral political framework prohibits these kinds of arbitrary deprivations of individual rights. So it's not that the judges are acting as philosopher kings, which is the usual straw man that I have thrown at me whenever I make these arguments. I'm arguing that, in fact, there is a conscience of the Constitution which the judges are obligated to enforce, and that is the classical liberal political philosophy articulated in the Declaration and the Constitution.
Well, this is Christian Corrigan again, and as Tim mentioned, we have reached the end of the hour. I want to thank both Tim Sandifer and Clark Neely for joining us today and offering a very spirited discussion, and for taking the time to be with us. Both The Conscience of the Constitution and Clark's book, Terms of Engagement, are available on Amazon, as well as the links to the books are available on our website. One quick programming note, I want to invite you all to join us for our next scheduled teleforum, which is Tuesday, February 11th at 2 o'clock on the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, featuring Professor David Bernstein and Professor William Eskridge, Jr. So I want to thank again our audience for joining us, as well as Tim Sandifer and Clark Neely. And until next time, we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.